Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, there are no comments to read today, so I'm looking forward to those comments coming in. But for today's program, I just want to jump right back into discussing Winston Churchill as the warrior statesman. And last program, we were working with what Churchill began to recognize about World War I. And he actually wrote this down after the war. But again, it was great writing, and it was a horrible, horrible time. Now, one of the things that we have to understand is that Churchill, again, if you just think back to what we've been talking about when he was, you know, early in his career as a soldier, if there wasn't a battle, he went out and found one. Well, the same thing happened during World War I. And of course, there's that horrible history of Flanders Field. Now, I had one of my uncles, again, I come from an old family. My mother was 13 out of 13 children. And so I'm seventh or sixth out of seven children. So I came pretty late in the game. But I had an uncle that actually had fought in Flanders Field. And I remember as a boy him talking about how horrible it was. But the thing is that Winston Churchill knew that there was just a slaughter going on in Flanders Field. And the geography was working against them. And, you know, it's trench warfare. The Germans were on one side. You know, the British and the French were on the other side. And they were just, lobbing bombs. They were, shooting bullets. They were, spreading gas. And if you go back to that last program, you can hear how he described it. You know, they were using flamethrowers. And, he wanted to do something about it. And, he knew that something had to be done to change it. And, of course, he believed what had to happen is Germany had to be attacked, not in Flanders Field, but Germany had to be attacked on its own soil. Now, here's what Hal Johnson describes it. And this is the bottom of page 49. But again, this was a big lesson that Churchill had to learn. It says, in his frustration, Churchill involved himself in a typical personal adventure. He had already created a naval division for land use and set up a base in Dunkirk. Now remember, this is Dunkirk during World War I, not during World War II, and we're going to discuss the miracle of Dunkirk from World War II. We're going to discuss that in a later program. But he already was aware, and he set up this base in Dunkirk, and this is on the English side of things. He had a naval air squadron there. He had a Rolls Royce that he commandeered. He put sheets of armor around it, so it was kind of like the earliest version of the tank. When the news reached the cabinet that the Belgians were about to surrender Ostend and Antwerp, thus defeating the whole object of Britain's intervention in the war, it ordered Churchill, a delighted volunteer, to go to Antwerp to take charge. He did so and had a tremendous time, commanding every available man and piece of artillery, improvising and inventing new weapons. And so again, Winston Churchill always looked for ways to better their weapons, or he had this inventive genius, and he was looking for new ways to win. He afterward described it in The World Crisis with rhetorical relish. He set up his headquarters in the best hotel, went around in a cloak and a yachting cap, and held the city for a week, during which the three chief French Channel ports, essential links between Britain and the expeditionary force, were made secure. But his proposal that he resign his office and be appointed commander on the spot, though approved by Kitchener, was rejected by the cabinet, and he was ordered home. Antwerp fell, and with it 2,000 British troops who were killed and taken prisoner, and Churchill was blamed, particularly by the Tories and senior army generals. Clemmy, who had a baby, Sarah, while her husband was fighting, was also critical. But the prime minister was warm in praise. He is so resourceful and undismayed, two of the qualities I like best. Now, again, Churchill was off, you know, getting his adventure. But, you know, that was a big mistake. He was not successful at what they needed done. And so, you know, it sounds like he was a little stuck on the Enchantress instead of facing the fact they were in a war. Now, later, after this, Churchill, he did write about it. He says, Churchill later wrote that the weight of the war pressed more heavily on him in the last months of 1914 than any other time, as the enormous and constantly expanding army settled down into static, bloody, and horrible trench warfare in Flanders. Churchill feared his nightmare vision was coming true, the vision of an endless, infinitely costly, but indecisive war in which all would lose, none gain, and the only result would be the ruin of Europe and her empires. And so again, there his amazing ability to size up a situation. And so he came up with another plan and a new plan. And this is where they realized they were going to have to attack Germany on its own soil. Now, what I just read to you was from page 50 of the book. Now let's start on page 51. He says, one answer was to make more use of Russia's almost inexhaustible manpower resources by shipping vast supplies of modern weapons, especially heavy artillery, to her Black Sea ports. But this meant knocking Turkey out of the war, or at any rate clearing the Dardanelles to let the British and the French munitions ships through. This is what Churchill suggested in a memo to Asquith at the end of 1914. He also offered an alternative, an invasion of Schleswig-Holstein, which Germany had conquered from Denmark in Bismarck's day. This, he calculated, would bring Denmark, perhaps all of the Scandinavian countries, into the war and also open up communications with Russia. But Churchill preferred an assault on Istanbul, which would be easier, giving overwhelming Franco-British superiority in the Mediterranean and bring the Balkan states of Greece, Romania, and Bulgaria into the war on the Allied side, probably Italy also. And so again, Churchill was a great strategist. But what he had to realize now, he had to get other people in power to agree with what he wanted to do. It says, Johnson continues, this view was acceptable in principle, but now it became clear, at least in retrospect, that Asquith, as prime minister, did not know how to run a war on such a scale. What British prime minister ever had, Aberdeen, had made a gruesome mess of British participation in the Crimean War. Pitt had blundered repeatedly in the Continental War against revolutionary France and Napoleon. Asquith, over 6 years, had proved a skillful peacetime leader, steering Britain through several crises by his adroit management of the House of Commons and the Cabinet, but he had no conception of the right way to win a world war. He could keep the Cabinet together and see that general policy orders were given to the services, but then he sat back and wrote amorous letters to his beloved Venetia Stanley or played bridge endlessly at his house, the Wharf. So Churchill may have had great ideas, but he was under authority, and he could not convince Asquith to work and to work with him or to act quickly. And so essentially, you know, they had to act quickly in order to make this happen. And of course, there was a real political kerfuffle over the whole thing. Now I'm just going to skip down again. We're on page 52 now. But they had to act quickly, and the war cabinet, they weren't cooperating. It says, hence the attempt to seize the Dardanelles, the narrow strip which was the key to the Sea of Marmara and Istanbul, was a disaster. The year before, Churchill had foolishly brought out of retirement Admiral John Fisher, the dynamic force. He was more than a human being who had created the original Dreadnought, which is a warship, and two more classes of capital ships to replace their Admiral Louis Battenberg, forced out by popular prejudice because he was German blood and as first sea lord. Fisher was now well into his 70s, and essentially this man was also, he was kind of like a Churchill. You know, he was gruff. He wasn't politically astute or maybe how to handle himself. And so it didn't reflect well on Churchill at all. Johnson goes on to say, there was a foolish tendency not shared by Churchill to underrate the Turks as fighting men. With a large contingent of German officers to advise and train them, the Turkish army was formidable. On January 31st, Asquith told Fisher, "I have heard Mr. Winston Churchill, and I have heard you, and now I am going to give my decision. The Dardanelles will go ahead." But unfortunately, the Germans were already aware of what was going to go on, and essentially what happened at the Dardanelles was a massacre. And we'll come back to one other statement Johnson makes in just a second. But here's what he says about what happened at the Dardanelles. He says, "It was a massacre, and the casualties were enormous. The divided command insisted on reinforcing failure, thus breaking the most elementary rule of strategy, and the death toll rose. Fisher noisily resigned. Asquith formed his coalition, moving Churchill, despite his almost tearful protest, from the Admiralty to the non-job of Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. It was the only time in his life that Clemmy, Churchill, made a dramatic appeal on behalf of her husband. She wrote to Asquith, 'Winston may, in your eyes and in those with whom he had to work, have faults, but he had the supreme quality which I venture to say very few of your present or future cabinet possess, the power, the imagination, the deadliness to fight Germany.'" Now, Johnson goes on to say this was true, but unavailing. Asquith was beginning to fight for his own political survival, and he saw the sacrifice of Churchill was essential to it. Besides, his noisy and dominating wife, Margot, whose shouted advice was to get rid of Churchill at any cost, told him, "I have never varied in my opinion of Winston. I am glad to say he is a hound of the lowest sort of political honor, a fool of the lowest judgment, and contemptible. He cured me of oratory in the house and bored me with oratory in the home." So essentially what happened to all of to Churchill at this time, he was out. He was pushed out. And it was terrible that they blamed Churchill for the problems when really the problem was in, the leadership of England. It was really a political blunder. And if they had, listened to Churchill in the beginning and did what he wanted to do, it would have really worked out. Even Johnson brings this out in the book, and this is on the top of page 53, said, "If Asquith had then appointed Churchill supremo of the operation and told him to replace Fisher, the campaign might still have succeeded. But he did no such thing. He was already thinking of forming a coalition with the Tories and knew that they would require Churchill's departure from the Admiralty as part of the price. There were endless arguments about the nature of the naval force and the relative importance of the army in the attack. The admirals were timid. The land commander, General Sir Ian Hamilton, was charming but lacked resolution. There were leaks from the cabinet which, under Asquith, had no sense of the absolute need for security, and by the time the operation began at the end of April 1915, the assaulting troops, mainly Australians and New Zealanders, plus Churchill's naval division, had not a chance." And so it was a big political blunder, and yet it was Churchill's fault. And that was probably the biggest casualty of all. And, the nation needed Churchill. They needed a warrior statesman. They needed someone that could see prophetically what was happening. Now, here's how, Johnson describes it. And again, this wasn't the worst time for Churchill. There was actually more times, more bad times coming and worse times as well. But here's what Johnson says on page 54. It says, "So Churchill was out and had to watch, impotent and silent, while the politicians, admirals, and generals compounded their mistakes, and the operation, after a quarter of a million casualties, ended in ignominious evacuations, though an official inquiry eventually exonerated him at the time, which is what mattered. He got the blame. As Theodore Roosevelt once remarked of a financial crisis, when people have lost their money, they strike out unthinkingly like a wounded snake at whoever is most prominent in the line of vision. And so here's Winston. You remember, his policy was to make himself conspicuous. His policy was to, you know, take the front lead. Well, when it came to the Dardanelles disaster, he was the most visible, so they got him. So, but Johnson goes on to say, here it was not money, but lives lost. And there was no doubt who was most prominent. So the Dardanelles disaster became identified with Churchill, and the fury this aroused persisted until 1940 and even beyond, especially among the Tories and a huge chunk of the public. Now, when we talk about the politics in England, we'll talk about the Tories, and we'll talk about the Labour Party, and we'll talk about the Liberal Party. We'll explain all of that to you. But what a disaster for England. What a disaster for the leadership. And unfortunately, the whole blame was put on Winston Churchill. But as I said earlier, you know, in these programs, Winston Churchill had to learn these lessons just to be able to get ahead for World War II. Now, here's also what Johnson says about this time in Churchill's life. It says, it was the lowest time in Churchill's life. At this point, Sir William Orpin, Britain's finest painter, did his portrait. It is the best ever done of Churchill, of the 50 or so that have survived, and one of the best Orpin himself ever produced. Dark, somber, troubled, defiant, just, but more despairing. When it was finished, Churchill sighed, "It's not the picture of a man, it's the picture of a man's soul." Orpin used to speak of the misery in his face. He called Churchill the man of misery. No one can understand him properly without looking long and earnestly at this great work, which is now in Dublin. A quarter of a century later, when Churchill was back at the top and able to look at his life more philosophically, he said, "Yes, it's good." He painted it just after I had to withdraw our forces from the Dardanelles, and I got turfed out. In fact, when he painted it, I pretty well lost everything. He brooded in his inactivity, something he had never experienced before. His wife later told Martin Gilbert, his great biographer, "I thought he would die of grief." And so essentially, that was a really bad time in Churchill's life. You know, he was now down and he was now out. But in some ways, you know, Winston Churchill, you know, it's interesting. You know, he didn't let things get him down. You know, he didn't let things, you know, beat him up. They had bought in this beautiful home in Chartwell, which I've had the real great pleasure to spend, you know, half a day there. It was a beautiful place. And so even though he was out politically, down and out, he was sacrificed by Asquith, you know what he did? He took up painting. And now that's another story, and his daughter wrote a book about him called Churchill the Painter. I think that's the title. But he actually learned how to work through the stress and the pressures of what he had gone through. And he actually became really a pretty decent painter. And I don't know how many of his paintings are still available, but you know, some of them are actually quite good. And so he didn't just, dry up into a prune. Here's what Johnson says about him. He said his first painting, The Garden at Ho Farm, with Goonie in the foreground. Now, was one of his sister-in-laws. She was Goonie Churchill, and that was her nickname, but she was actually Lady Gwendolyn Birdie. It says his first painting, The Garden at Ho Farm, with Goonie in the foreground, survives. Soon misery began to retreat. His mind, his self-respect, his confidence were restored. He found he could paint strikingly and loved it. His efforts improved with each canvas. The colors were strong and cheerful. His friends liked them and were delighted to have them. He had discovered a new field to conquer with his audacity. Painting after politics and the family became his chief passion, and he painted for the rest of his life as the perfect relaxation from his tremendous cares. And so there in the ignominy of defeat, Churchill didn't give up. He became a great painter. So we can all learn from that. One last thing I want to do, we're going to continue this next time. But one thing I wanted to do, I still have a little bit of time. I wanted to read to you a very famous poem by John McCrae about Flanders Fields. And it's a very moving poem. And it really does kind of sum up what happened during World War One. And again, it's a very short poem, but it's very beautiful. It says, "In Flanders Fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields." So, next time we will continue our discussion of Churchill the warrior, but we're going to get into Churchill and the miracle of Dunkirk. And so, remember, we are quickly approaching the second book in this series, also by Paul Johnson. The book is titled George Washington, Founding Father. You can find this book on Amazon for about $13 for Prime members. You can find a used copy of the book for around $4 at abebooks.com. Now, please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.